I'd like to introduce our guest speaker for tonight, and it's going to be Billy N speaking on singleness of purpose.
Hi, my name is Billy Noonan. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here tonight. I got to say a few things before I start off on this topic because there's no doubt that I am going to say minimal five things that are probably going to bother, offend somebody because this is like the topic of all topics in our fellowship. I mean, it is probably the one thing that keeps us together, but yet the one thing that has the power to drive us apart more than anything else, and I really do believe that. And I'm going to talk tonight based on my experience, so I want to make sure we're all clear on what that is. My experience is being, whether you want to call myself a member of AA from 14 to 23 or a visitor to AA, however you want to term that period, I can't help but tell you that that's part of my AA experience because I lived it. I might not have stayed sober, but I lived in and out of AA during that period. Then I have a period of AA where I was an AA member on Long Island, and then I have a period of AA where I was an AA member in a correctional facility, in a member of a correctional facility group. You know, and then after that, I have a period of AA in New York City where I was homeless for a while, lived in a welfare hotel, probably didn't live the life that I live today. So I can't take that experience away either. And then, you know, I took a job and went to Chicago for 7 years. And so I have that AA experience. And now I have the AA experience of living here for over 2 years. And so one of the things about that is you get exposed to many different things. And so I'm going to try to focus on experiences I've been exposed to rather than opinions that I've developed, because God knows I've developed thousands of them, you know, and they have a proper place outside in the parking lot or in a diner, but probably not from this podium. I should try and focus on experiences. You know, it's amazing because I just got off the phone with a friend of mine. I just called him. When we talk about the traditions and singleness of purpose and primary purpose, we have a lot of catchphrases. We have a lot of catchwords. But somebody showed me a flyer that they said I wouldn't believe because it has a good friend of mine on it speaking, and it says, 8 o'clock p.m., guest speaker, national AA speaker, and then his name. So I had to call him and say, you're not going to believe what I have in my hand. And he said, there's no way you're just giving me a hard time because we're known to give each other hard times. And I said, I really can't. I'm not giving you a hard time. And then I look at it further and, you know, there's two pictures of Bill W. on there. And, you know, if you're familiar with our traditions, anonymity after someone dies, it's AA's group conscience that only a family can break it. It's not our right to break a fellow member's anonymity. I mean, it's clear in AA's group conscience that if someone dies and the family wants to list in the obituary, was a member of the so-and-so group, wife was saved by AA, dedicated member of AA, we don't take that right away from any family. That's our group conscience. It's their right. The person's passed away. The family should make that decision. But we do have a clear group conscience that we never break anyone's anonymity, dead or alive, whether by showing pictures of them, whether by naming their names. So now I see this very public flyer with Bill's picture on it, and I think, boy, how did that slip by? And I'm not saying it because there's anything, you know, God knows I've done more things wrong with flyers and committees. It's just when you start to go down a slippery slope and you start to water down the traditions, more and more things become acceptable. I do know that as a fact of life. I know it whether it's in a home group, a committee, an area committee, and I want to throw a couple other things out there about my experience. Then I have the experience of being a member of the International Conference of Young People in AA Advisory Council. So being to a number of those conferences, traveling as an elected trusted servant to cities where young people were putting together bids to host that conference, 6 years as an area officer of attending regional events, attending, you know, regional forums, you know, 2 years as a delegate and going to the General Service Conference. So My experience tonight, I can assure you, has been affected by everything I've witnessed in that window of time. There are a couple of things I told Mike, and I have to repeat the questions he said, but I need to find my note card. I'm probably going to allow ask. I probably am not going to speak for an hour on singleness of purpose. I mean, seems like that singleness of purpose would be to make sure you never come back to hear anyone ever speak on singleness of purpose again, you know? And I don't definitely want to do that, so I'm going to open it up for some questions or comments later on, and I'll repeat them into the microphone. But there are a couple of things I want to say for you to think about. I'm not here to win over your opinion to mine, but I am going to throw out some really, I think, topics that we face every day in AA so that you can think about them. I know that this weekend, singleness of purpose is definitely on my mind. I recently was named as an appointed committee member of the Trustees Corrections Committee, and this will be the first board weekend I go to. And one of the agenda items on my committee is whether or not to put a singleness of purpose statement in a pamphlet for corrections professionals. And I can assure you that there are two very diametrically opposing views on that. Although the delegates are unanimously, you know, that the committee felt unanimously. So Saturday I will go and talk about singleness of purpose from that point of view. But a couple of things I just want to throw out there are things that have been said to me by members who have been around here 30 or 40 years to think about, just questions to think about in my mind. And one of those questions that, you know, someone I respect says, you know, do we worry more about who's in our meeting and who to throw out more than we worry about making sure that the alcoholic who hasn't found us has found us? So that's a question that I find a good one to think about, especially for a person like me who can be very opinionated, to really set me straight as to what am I really focusing on. The other question is, we seem to have a definite opinion in AA, and when I say AA, I'm saying what I've experienced as far as drug addiction. And I'm not talking about it with alcoholism. I'm just talking about drug addiction alone. But yet, we don't seem to have that same kind of militant fervor against the heavy drinker who's not an alcoholic. And my experience is that there's lots of heavy drinkers in AA who do not need the same program of action that I have. And so I've been asked that question, too, not whether it's good or bad, but just to think about AA as a whole, should, you know, does that ever run through my head? And, you know, there's a gentleman that I respect an awful lot. He's been sober 40-something years. And I was at a conference that he spoke at, and he was almost in tears telling a story of a recent new sponsee. Now, this gentleman got sober. If he's 40-something years sober, he came to AA in, like, 57 or 58, didn't get sober to 61 or 2. But he had received a call from his minister, and this is also a gentleman who didn't find a church that he felt comfortable with until his 39th year of sobriety. So let's just say that he's had the God problem his whole sobriety, and now is on the board of his church in his 40s. And by 40s, I mean chronologically his 70s. It took him 30-something years sober to develop his real spiritual belief. But one of the things he said is that his minister had called him recently and said that he had a 27-year-old guy who had just bottomed out on alcohol and hated AA and was George willing to... I didn't want to say his name. God damn it. Was he willing to talk to him? And he said, of course I'm willing to talk to him. And he had him come over to his house, and he asked him to tell him a little bit about himself. And they wanted to know what he hated about AA. And what George said to me after that was that basically all the things the guy listed, he hates about AA, you know? But they, one had like 40 days, one had 40 years, and the things that bothered him about AA were the same, you know? But what was interesting, he said, about his story was that he had been to AA before when he was 19. But at 19 years old, when... It's my experience in AA and hearing from people who were active in their teenage years. It just is a whether society accepts it or not is okay, but the fact of the matter is, it's harder to buy alcohol than to buy drugs when you're a teenager. That's just a fact of life. People who sell drugs don't ID. Don't ask for card, don't card you. You know, people who sell alcohol do ask for ID. I mean, I'm not here to debate that fact. I'm not here. That's just something we live with. And so when this kid was 19 years old and bottomed out on another substance and alcohol, and he wound up in AA, he wound up in a place in a group in AA where they basically said, you haven't drank enough. You don't belong here. And he left. And so for the next 10 years, drank and did other things like he did. And so George's comment to this audience that night was, if you believe in the big book, if you believe in the doctor's opinion and you believe in what it says and there is a solution to more about alcoholism, it's like pregnancy. You either are or you aren't. There is no real middle-of-the-road solution there. You maybe you're a social drinker, maybe you're a heavy drinker, but you either are or aren't an alcoholic of our type. And so, you know, what George was trying to point out is, you know, how sad is it that people didn't take enough time to find out whether he was? They spent so much time focusing on whether he wasn't. You know, and so that thought has always gone through my mind of judging people and of, you know, those that come in here pretty beaten up, it takes them a long time to really be able to really tell you their story or what they've been through. You know, a lot of people, it takes a long time. Some people don't open up much longer than others. You know, there's another person I know, you know, we get into these arguments, and I believe that identifying yourself as an alcoholic is important in an AA meeting. That's just my opinion, my experience. But if you go back 50 years ago, that's not what they said. If you go back 40 years ago, it's not what they said. They just said, hi, my name's Billy. Didn't say what they were. What you were started as a result to when people were other things besides alcoholics. And, you know, I believe that no matter what your problem is, if you're an alcoholic, I believe strongly about the newcomer walking in the door who's never been to AA before. And that if I don't know somebody, it's really upon me to treat the person who walks in the door like they've never been to AA before, because I've never met them. Once I meet them, they tell me I have the year, I have 10 years, they've been to AA before, they've been in and out. Well, then maybe I know a little bit about them. But until I know that, I have to believe that what they're seeing today is the first representation of AA that they've ever seen and may affect whether they believe this is a place they want to stay. I do not believe that we can't ever do anything to send someone out the door. I don't believe that at all. I believe we can. I believe you can say things about people. I believe you can say something in a meeting from a podium that's not appropriate, and you do have – people don't show up here together. They show up here broken beyond all comprehension, emotionally, spiritually, mentally. And, you know, so I know this one guy who's a pretty militant singleness of purpose person, except his view on what people identify themselves at is he doesn't believe a thing a newcomer says for a year. So why would he even worry about what they're calling themselves? He just thinks, I don't believe what they tell me at the diner. I don't believe what they told me before the meeting. I don't believe what they told me on the phone. I don't believe anything they tell me for a long time. So why do I get so caught up in what they're calling themselves, you know? And so I can see his point of view there. I think it's a one way of looking at something that maybe I never thought of, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying I have to keep my mind open enough that maybe he has something there. Maybe he's seen something in his experience that's led him to start believing like this. I do believe very strongly that there still are people who make it here who have not used anything else besides alcohol. That's just a fact of life. I'm pretty much one of those people. I've used something else a couple of times, but I think we owe it to make sure that any newcomer who comes in knows they're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, that this is AA. If I heard people say, well, I'm an overeater, I'm an addict, I'm this, I'm that, I'm a gambler, I might not know if I belong because I don't have any of those problems. Now, I think most people who've been around a while know that whether it's a man or a woman walking in a door, they basically could at least say their five things. I mean, I don't run into anyone that comes into AA that couldn't add on to the list, whether they want to admit it or not. They could add on to that list. I mean, it's just a fact of life. You know, I don't care if it's sex, gambling, relationships, codependency, gambling, the whole bit. You know, whether you want to call them character defects or not, call them whatever you want. But if you've heard enough fifth steps, you come to realize that everybody walking in the door didn't just, you know, was a nice guy, a girl who drank too much, you know? I mean, that's just not who stays here. That's not who stays around, you know? That's not who suffer from the spiritual illness that we talk about. And so I think George's theory of you either are pregnant or you're not, you know, it means a lot to me. You know, I want to say this, that one of the things I think that I've experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous is that, first of all, there's like we get these cliques or groups of people, or they get lotted into certain classes in AA. And however that may be is fine, but we have literature. And sometimes I find I've been guilty of it, that when the literature's in my favor, I'm willing to tell you the page it's on, the paragraph, and the sentence. But when the literature is not in my favor, I don't refer to it. In fact, I will act like it doesn't even exist. I'll act like, well, that's not the big book, or that's in the story section, or, you know, I'll come up with something to say. And I think what I really have to ask myself, am I willing to really say to myself that whatever is conference-approved literature that's been voted on by the AA General Service Conference and accepted as AA General Service Conference literature approved, am I willing to go along with all of those instead of taking out what I like and leaving the rest? Because I find it interesting sometimes, and I throw this out just so that you can, you know, think about it for a while, because I think about it, is that I like meetings that talk about the big book and talk about the solution. But what happens when someone goes so far extreme that they tell a newcomer or somebody with maybe 10 years that has a character defect that may have crossed the boundary to a disease of its own, AA can fix everything. You don't need Al-Anon. I know that your husband still drinks. I know he comes home every night. When he does come home, you're lucky. But AA can fix that problem. But yet my literature clearly says that we're not the experts in dealing with family members. You know, that's just what my literature says. My literature, so, but what happens when we tell somebody that? What are they going to do? They're going to come to our meetings and share about their husband or their wife or their son or daughter. If we keep telling them that this is the only answer, I mean, it's the same when we talk about doctors or medicine or professional counseling. I am a person who's gone to counseling, so I can say that from the podium. It's not part of really my AA story. The only way it's somehow remoted connected to AA is that I killed someone drinking and driving, and someone in AA told me AA was not designed to put me behind the wheel of a car again. He told me AA was designed so that I wouldn't pick up a drink again if I had a spiritual experience. But that if I had this, like, overwhelming fear and this overwhelming guilt, that so much so that I was paralyzed from getting behind the wheel of a car again. Now, thank God I was prevented from getting behind the wheel of a car again legally for quite a while. But I couldn't even fathom getting behind the wheel of a car. But somebody was smart enough to say to me, you need to find someone who works with people like you. And the reason I say that is, I believe that I got behind the wheel of a car again because of the help I received there, and I'm not ashamed of it. But my book also tells people that are working with new people to make yourself available of what the world has to offer, to make yourself available to professionals. And so I use myself as an example. What about if I had nowhere to go? Well, I'm pretty sure then I would be talking all the time in AA meetings. I'm scared to drive again. I don't think I can drive again. You know, and I, as I heard somebody say recently, an Al-Anon speaker, and I think it's just a great line, is if you don't identify with my problem, you're never going to identify with my solution. I think that is a great line. So what about if I'm in a meeting? No one has a solution for getting behind the wheel of a car again after you've killed someone drinking and driving. We don't have a book about that. We don't have a solution for that. We have a solution to stop and remain sober. But the two are different. And so when I see people say, well, don't go to counseling, don't get professional help, I start to wonder, well, then you better be willing to hear what they have to share back at the meetings. You know, you better be willing to hear what they have to say. And I think that we cross a line sometimes, and we focus more on our singleness of purpose than our primary purpose. You know, if you read our literature, primary purpose is mentioned much more than singleness of purpose. It just is. Singleness of purpose, in fact, is really created by outside people. I don't mean outside AA. But if you look at what's been written about AA over the last almost 70 years, what the outside world has said, some of the smartest people in the world, is what makes us good is that we stick to what we're good at. We stick to one thing. We know about, we have a solution for one thing. Now, our book does say in a couple of places, this solution may help you in other areas. I'm not saying it won't. I'm not up here saying that it's only going to help you stop drinking. Obviously, I don't believe that. But I just think as a human being, if I want to be truthful, I know when I'm dealing with someone who's just going to, let's just say, Atlantic City one night a month and maybe blowing a paycheck, compared to when I'm dealing with someone who's calling the bookie every day, going to Atlantic City every night. I am smart enough now, I think, because I'm an idiot usually, that I've listened to the people in front of me to say, you may need to pick up the phone and call Gamblers Anonymous. I don't have a solution for you. I've never recovered from compulsive gambling. And AA is not going to help you recover from compulsive gambling. And I think somewhat, and I've been taught from the men that, and women that I've really talked to, is that when we keep telling people that we have the solution for everything, we kind of create our own problems. We're kind of inviting them, all those problems, in the rooms of AA. I think AA history, and someone actually beat me to the punch, you know, it's a myth that the first 100 people didn't use other stuff. I mean, if you've been told that, if you believe that, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I'm here to tell you that the first 100, on top of the people in the 40s, they all used other stuff. It had different names. I could care less that they used that other stuff. I care that they're an alcoholic. But I hate to see a newcomer in 2004 who maybe uses something that has a bad connotation name to it, whether it's called crack or heroin, or ecstasy, when back in the 40s, if I go to AA Comes of Age, and I go to page 102, and I don't want to act like this page doesn't exist, and I don't want to act like Bill Wilson did not write this, where he's talking about Tradition 3, and he says, Tradition 3 for a long time was a puzzle of two. The only requirement for AA membership is a sincere desire to stop drinking. We worried a long time about membership. In fact, when heavy publicity first came our way, we were scared witless. We said to ourselves, won't all kinds of odd people show up? This is AA. I mean, what are we talking about? I mean, AA, for Christ's sake. And then it says, complications, you know. alcohol mixed with other things. That's in like 1946 he wrote this. And then he goes on to say, and it's so much, he was such a visionary because it sounds like any diner or AA meeting I've been in where he says, in those days we were always talking about the mythical character called the pure alcoholic. In the 1940s. No complications, you understand, just the guzzler. And then he says, we actually thought we were like that ourselves. Which is just like the people I meet in AA today who stay here a couple of years, and all of a sudden, they don't want to admit who they were when they came in. You know, it says, mixed with a certain amount of snobbishness and smugness, this was downright fear. We simply did not know what or who would turn up. And so I think that is one of the most powerful paragraphs in all of our literature. And I'm not here condoning dual-purpose meetings. I'm not here saying, I think the other pamphlet that's not used enough is this one, you know, because I think it's clear there. You know, it says, can a non-alcoholic pill or drug addict become an AA member? No, because you have to be an alcoholic. Can such a person be brought as a visitor to an open AA meeting? Yes. If so, should these non-alcoholic pill or drug users be led to believe that they have become AA members? No. Can a pill or drug taker who has also a genuine alcoholic history become a member of AA? Yes. I mean, we have very few things clear in our literature. We love to write things that are just open and lots of room for interpretation. And if you write a letter to the General Service Office, I assure you it'll be started with, our experience shows us, I mean, some kind of hokey, open-ended, never reaches a point, never reaches a conclusion. And I'm not saying they should. I'm just saying those are the letters they write because they don't want to get put in a box. And so, but this is very simple. And so, you know, to me it's very simple. The singleness of purpose is it doesn't matter if you're a fast driver or a bank robber or an overeater. What matters is if you're an alcoholic. You know, I think somehow or another, and maybe I used to see it more in New York City, and I don't think that's against New York City AA as much as the dynamics. AA always reflects the community around it. I mean, where you meet, you usually reflect that outside community. And if you go to urban AA, you reflect the outside community. And my experience is it looks a lot different than suburban AA. And it sounds a hell of a lot different than suburban AA. And I've seen people mistake going through the 12 steps and having the right to be a sponsor with becoming a rape crisis intervention counselor or an incest counselor or, a battered wife counselor. Things that we have no experience with, all of a sudden somebody has a year of sobriety and they've gone through the steps and we're helping people with things that we have absolutely no business getting involved in. Now, some of us as individuals have experience. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. When I lived in Chicago, I had 3 sponsees go through very challenging custody battles. I have no children, hence I've never been in a custody battle. Hence, hearing what they had to say, was glad I was never in a custody battle. But I had no real advice to give them, you know? What did I know about custody battles? You know, I don't know anything about it. What I do know is I may know a few people in AA who've been through a custody battle, and not that that should be a topic in a meeting, but I can send them to meet this person. I can deflate my ego a little bit and say, you know what? I don't know jack about that. But you know what? I heard somebody else in a diner, they've been through the same thing. You know, it's like the IRS. God knows, if you want to find out how to deal with the IRS, talk about it in an AA meeting, because it seems we all have been ripping up letters for a long time. I find that we all have a lot in common there. We have been getting letters and not opening them and just throwing them out. But not everybody has that experience. But when I had that problem, when I finally was going to open that letter and read it, I went to someone who had that experience. And so I think when we're talking about alcoholism, it's one thing to say your group's for alcoholics. That's great. But if your group spends, or if you spend most of your time worried about what else they are, instead of that they are alcoholic, I can't reconcile that with the literature. I find it hard to reconcile that with the literature. You know, there's the story that a lot of people talk about is the story of, you know, when the person walks into the meeting and they say they're not sure if AA is the place for them, that they have a social stigma much worse than alcoholism. And most people who have not looked into the history believe they're talking about drug addiction, and they're not. That was a cross-dressing transsexual who walked into that meeting, who happened to have a drinking problem. And they say they call the founder. That's what they say in the story, in the literature. And the founder says, what would the master do? And it's, what would the master do is, who cares if it's a transsexual? Who cares if they're gay? Who cares if they're straight? Are they an alcoholic? Do they have a genuine desire to stop drinking? And so, you know, that's why I think traditions meetings are great. That's why I think that, you know, I'm going to talk about a subject now. It's probably going to take a little flack, but I'm going to talk about it. Because as a member of AA, I think I have a right to feel disappointed in AA at times. And I feel disappointed that maybe I'm not doing my part enough. Because, you know, recently a new fellowship started, especially in New Jersey, and it's called Alcoholics and Narcotics Anonymous. And they've formed their own board, and they have meetings. And so, personally, I may have a problem with the name Alcoholics Anonymous being used with one other word in the middle of it. That's my personal problem. My interpretation of the traditions is that it's not proper, that no one should be using that name except AA. And putting one other word in the middle of it does not change it. But worse than that, when I went to an old-timer, he actually said that it makes him want to shed a tear for AA. That if these people really are alcoholic and addicts, how did they get chased out of AA? How did they feel so? I figured he was going to say the opposite. Thank God they formed their own fellowship. Been trying to get rid of them for years, you know? That's what I thought he was going to say, you know? Because you hear people say that. Drug addicts wrecked AA. You hear all kinds of things. Instead, he felt the exact opposite. He felt, God, what's happening to our fellowship that by their very name they qualify for AA membership yet didn't feel welcome in an AA meeting? And so maybe he's wrong. Maybe he's right. I know it's enough to make a guy like me think. It's enough to make a guy like me ponder the next time I'm dealing with somebody. You know, my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous from all different facets is that, first of all, as a member sitting in a chair, looking around at the rest of the meeting, looking at somebody getting up and getting a cup of coffee, looking at the person chairing, and any one of those people could be somebody I can't stand. Or maybe I say to myself, God, I don't know how they can act like that when they're sober. I could never do that. You know what I heard a lady with like 30-something years say in a meeting? She said every time she said to herself, God, I don't know how they can do that and stay sober, she did it. That was her experience in over 30 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. That every time she put someone else down, it might not have been a day later, it might not have been a week later, it might have been 10 years later, she found herself in that person's footsteps. And, you know, I think that Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole, if you open your ears sometimes, you hear things that will go against what you believe is true. It happens to me. You know, for some reason, I think I just have to admit it. See, I was an alcoholic, and I knew I was an alcoholic probably for a good number of years in my teens. But It definitely, when you are working with teenagers and young people, it is definitely cooler to be something else. I mean, I wish we had a chapter on it. We don't. But if we're just going to deal with street-level mentality and not live in some philosophical glass house where we don't deal with the truth, we have to admit, if you're 17 years old, it's cooler to be a drug addict than an alcoholic. That's just what they tell me. That's what 17, 18, 19-year-olds have told me, that they'll do whatever they can to deny their alcoholism. And the other thing that I have to talk about is, and here I probably will take a little bit of a harder position, is I think that I am a member of AA who has great respect for the treatment center community. And I like to think that I hold myself up to doing what the traditions tell me, which is to cooperate, never criticize. I believe that is my job as a member. But I have to tell you that my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is that when I respect that 28-day period, or I respect when they get, you know, held over and they become a 60- or a 90-day person in treatment center, I know it's my job as an AA member to cooperate, never criticize. That my book says some people may need to get some medical treatment before they get sober, or before they really indoctrinate into AA. But my experience in AA is that the respect that AA has for that 28 days does not go both ways. My experience is that the treatment community, in their aftercare programs, set up sponsors to get into battles between the aftercare counselor and the sponsor, which is a battle that I refuse to even go into anymore, that I make very clear that if you have an aftercare counselor, that's aftercare, that's between you and them, but I'm not ever interested about you telling me, well, my counselor says I don't need to do that. I'm not personally, I don't care what your counselor has to say personally. I care very much that you comply with your aftercare program. I care very much that I never tell you not to go. I care very much that if you have a prescription from a doctor, that I don't ever practice medicine. I care a lot about those things. I may have opinions. I may think doctors overprescribe, but those are my opinions as a human being. I don't enter into that arena. But when they start entering into ours and start telling people, well, you don't need to do service. You know, let me hand you this sheet just like this, and it is nice and convenient, and if you stay away from all these things, you won't drink. You know? Well, that's not what our book says. I mean, and I think about our singleness of purpose. We also have to have a singleness of purpose about our recovery program. We have one. It's in the big book. Is there room for interpretation? Yes, of course there is. There are people I respect greatly who disagree on certain things. But we really do only have one program of recovery. And if you believe what it says in the doctor's opinion and more about alcoholism and there is a solution, how you showed up to AA has nothing to do with whether you suffer from alcoholism or not. Recently, I've had two people put in my life who have killed people drinking and driving. And I've talked to them on the phone. And you know what's interesting is whenever I'm dealing with somebody like that, or I'm dealing with a sponsor who's working with someone like that, the most important thing for me was to realize that I was an alcoholic the day before I had my car accident, or before I got into the car that night. Because when you're working with someone who's done something like that, and I'm not making it a unique circumstance, but unfortunately, if you do that in society today, your whole life becomes about that accident. Every day you are reminded of it, whether it is through probation, whether you're in custody, whether you're doing 1,500 hours of community service speaking in high schools, whether it's Mothers Against Drunk Driving showing up at every one of your court appearances to make sure that you know they're there and they're there to make sure the judge gives you a sentence that they think is right. Your life is surrounded by that accident. So it's hard to understand that that accident has nothing to do with me being an alcoholic. You know, it's like the kid who came to see George. I came to AA in my young teens. I stayed sober this time when I was 23. Did my external conditions change? Yes. Did the internal condition that I suffer from change? Absolutely not. From the time I was 15 and 14 until the time I was 23, life might have gotten worse. My consequences might have gotten worse. But the condition that I suffer from didn't get worse. It, maybe it did, but it didn't change. It's called alcoholism. It's called the physical allergy. It's called the compulsion. That never changed. So when I have to deal with a counselor who tells one of my people I'm trying to help that says, stay away from old places, don't go into bars, don't go near known drug locations, stay away from your family, you know, this whole list of how to stay sober, you know, and it's my joke, you know, because I have one of these, you know, I have one of these lists from when I was on a panel with someone who was using it. And, you know, what I wanted to say to them is, you know, for God's sakes, put a perfect day on there. Warn your people not to have a perfect day. Because our book says, not a cloud in the sky, on the horizon. It was the end of a perfect day. So do you warn your people not to have a perfect day? Whatever you do, number 14, do not have a perfect day, you know? I mean, that's not our singleness of purpose. You know, I hear a lot about people, places, and things. I don't know where that is in our book, but I hear a lot about it. I know that it's smart to stay away from a bar if you're a newcomer. I realize that. But I don't think I need to let anyone know that they're handicapped by certain things for the rest of their recovery, that they can never do certain things, that they can never go hear Metallica in my case, that they never, you know, this past Saturday, I had a Yankee shirt on, and I was in Fenway at the game of the fight with A-Rod. It was not a popular day to be in Fenway with a Yankee jersey on, you know? My book doesn't tell me I can't go to Red Sox-Yankees games. It doesn't tell me, whatever you do, Billy, stay away from Red Sox-Yankee games with lots of drunk fans around. My book tells me that I can go back and live life as much as I want. And so I worry about singleness of purpose, that it's kind of been made to be only one thing, which is, if you're a drug addict, leave. You know, instead of meaning our primary purpose, which is if you're an alcoholic, we have a place for you to recover. You know, and that if I'm open-minded enough, my book tells me that, you know, if you have some other problems and the steps don't address them and a character defect seems to be more of its own addiction, well, then I have to be open-minded enough to send you someplace and, you know, Bill Wilson, I believe, was a very, very smart man. Yes, he had defects, but I know that no person gave up more of his individual life than he did. He didn't get to be Bill Wilson, ever. He didn't know what it was like to be Bill Wilson. He never got to lead the life that God meant for him to lead, unless you believe that that was the God life God meant for him to believe. But if you read his late writings, if you read his letters about depression, you know, if you read why AA was given back to the groups, it was because Bill hated being the final word. He hated being that guy. He hated, you know, and it was a spiritual advisor of his who told him that, you know, he probably would drink, he probably would disintegrate in depression if he didn't give AA back. And so, knowing all those things about him, I'm amazed at how open-minded he was. There's a grapevine. I didn't have mine with me because I started out in a different state today and got an airplane and I couldn't get home. But there's a great article. If you're ever at a convention or GSO or in a group, there's a two-set grapevine edition. It's in a white envelope that looks like an old report card when I was a kid. And on the front of it, it says Memorial Editions of the Grapevine. And it's the memorial edition from when Dr. Bob died. And it's the memorial edition. It's a story about the three legacies. And under the legacy of recovery, Bill writes a story about in 1968. And you know what I find amazing after reading this from Bill is that if you're an old-timer and you have like 30 or 40 years in AA and you came in AA in like the 60s, chances are you were a hippie or a flower child or something, a Vietnam veteran. Chances are, you know, when we look back at that time and period, you know, all of a sudden they didn't do anything else. And Bill writes that he was in his office and that the International Conference of Young People in AA was going on in Philadelphia that year, and that a couple of people came up to visit him at his office, a group of young boys and girls. And what he writes is that he was sitting in his office, he looked down the hallway, and he said to himself, "Holy smoke," he's saying to himself in his mind, "I can't believe what is coming down the hallway." You know, like these young guys and girls, and he describes the girl as being in a miniskirt, wearing love beads, and he says something about the works, you know, like they looked like young people in 1968, and they were teenagers. And he says that he met with them, and that he took them out to lunch, and that they all told him they had used drugs, but that they were alcoholic, and that if they used the program of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, that their drug problem was taken care of also. And then he says, "I was amazed that they were some of the best AA members I had ever met." And so I read that, and I'm not saying, I'm not pro-drug, I'm not saying I want AA to open up its doors and let everybody in. I'm just saying, look how open-minded Bill was. Look at what he thought when he saw these kids coming down the hallway, you know, and then he took them out to lunch, and he talked to them for a little while, and he realized, you know, oh my God, you know what's going on, and that story is a great story. And then he talked about a letter he got from a guy who said that he was afraid that the hippies and the flower children were going to destroy Alcoholics Anonymous. And Bill's response to him was, "I don't think so. All kinds of groups we've thought were going to destroy AA. Prohibition, all kinds of things. You know, a lot of people, you know, the traditions we have, and singleness of purpose is really somewhere the third and the fifth, but when we were first not even the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous, when we were something called the Alcoholic Foundation, which goes back many years ago, we only really had one thing we wouldn't do in the bylaws. Most people don't know this, but the one thing we would not do is lobby against prohibition. That's the only thing we couldn't do under the old set of rules. We could open up hospitals, open up treatment centers, open up, you know, detoxes. We could do just about anything. It wasn't until the General Service Board and the 12 traditions that we thought about how bad some of those things were. But when we talk about singleness of purpose, you know, I want AA to be here for the person who's not here today. That's just that simple. You know, our trivial fights about who belongs in AA and who doesn't, you know, I hear people talk about specialty meetings, women's meetings, men's meetings, gay meetings, doctors' meetings, pilots' meetings, lawyers' meetings. I mean, there's a whole list of those meetings. Do I think they violate AA's traditions? I don't. Why is that? I might have at one time. Because it's hard for me to talk to someone who's 20 years sober who tells me that their men's meeting, that that's their group, and they show up there every week, and that's where they get recovery. Or a woman who goes to a woman's meeting, you know, or, you know, let's just talk about a gay meeting for a second. You know, I honestly believe that what does make it a traditions violation is when someone who doesn't fit into that category walks in and they don't let him or her stay. Then I can't reconcile it with the literature. Then I can't find a place in the literature that says it's okay to do that. Because I know meetings of all types that let people out, but I need to open my mind. If you're a young gay male coming through the door, honestly, I'd be scared to sit in a meeting with somebody like myself 14 years ago. If the way society treated you or the way a straight, Irish, homophobic, drunk idiot treated you, I don't know if I'd feel safe wanting to go into a room and sit next to a bunch of them. I really don't. I kind of think I'd be scared. You know? It'd like be inviting me to the Mothers Against Drunk Driving convention when I was 2 days sober. You know? I wouldn't want to go there. Those people hate me. And so I run into all these people who for their first year wouldn't admit they were an alcoholic and now are 30 years sober. You know, I run into all these people that say things like, you know, that alcohol was just, you know, was their delusion, their denial. They never wanted to admit it. But I feel bad for the people who never had, who, where someone let what a newcomer said get in the way of trying to take them through the book and let themselves ask the questions if they belong here or not, instead of deciding for someone else. I can't find anywhere in this book where it says it's my decision and my choice to determine whether someone belongs here. Or is it the choice of the member who's been here to take someone through the book and let them answer their own questions, let them find their own truths? So this is a topic that I'm sure is going to be around forever. I am sure, you know, we hear all kinds of things. But I think I've said enough on it, and if there's anyone who wants to say something or ask a question or anything, I'd be glad to open it up right now. So that's all really I have. Yes? If you can find it written in the literature, I'd love to know. But I, singleness of purpose seems to be in the old history written about, that what makes us so good at what we do is we stick to alcoholism. It doesn't matter what someone else, whatever they are, bank robber, drug addict, gambler, but we stick to alcoholism. Primary purpose is talked about in the traditions, you know, and what AA's primary purpose is, you know. So I think it's a fine line. It's a very fine line. Any other questions, comments, disagreements? Nothing better than a good disagreement. Really. I really, really encourage it. You know, because I want to point out that I could use some things as examples of when my mind has been changed. You know, the pamphlets. We have a pamphlet for every type of person in the world. Just about now. We can just about get you a pamphlet. Indian, gay, lesbian, clergy, we have a pamphlet, right? The woman is the oldest pamphlet. But I'm always amazed when you look at the stats of how many pamphlets are ordered each year. You know, how many pamphlets, when you look at them, the ones that are ordered the most, and you look at the years they were ordered, people are ordering them for a reason. You know, the woman's pamphlet obviously got written because for a long time, believe it or not, men were not really open to having women in AA meetings. And you can read the literature. It's nice. It's sanitized a little bit. It definitely is. Because if you hear the real history, there were some definite feelings, you know, or how a woman felt walking into AA in 1939 or 1940, that if she was also an alcoholic, she was also a whore. I mean, I don't mean to use that word, but I'm just saying that when you read the history, that's the connotation that came there. And there are some communities in the United States today and in the world, some ethnic groups, where we don't have the acceptance of women alcoholics. In fact, there are women alcoholics dying in certain ethnic groups today, and I can say that safely, because the male population has not welcomed them into AA like they should. And, you know, I'd be glad to talk after the meeting, you know, where my experience comes from, but I can tell you that's personal experience. Yes? I'll give you an example of that. We've had great debates since I've been in AA about signing slips. God knows how many business meetings I've been in about whether we sign slips at this group or not. But what's amazing about that is if you go back in AA's history, the courts didn't come to us. We went to them. In fact, if you go into AA archives in Chicago, Los Angeles, you'll find that every big book was sold with an extra sheet in the front that they all put in, that they put in to refer people to courts. So here we are telling courts in the 1940s and 50s, send your people to AA. And then in the 80s, because they came and didn't look like the other people we used to have come, what does that mean? They weren't white, Irish, male in their 40s or 50s? I mean, that's personally, I know that we can talk about AA is so spiritual, but I can tell you that personally, yes, I have seen racism in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yes, I have seen anti-Semitism. Yes, I have seen homophobia. So that's just my human truth. I've seen that. I talk about pamphlets, you know, whether we need them or not. Some people don't think we should get any more. But yet I read a letter from a woman who's 20-something years sober or 15 years sober, and she writes a letter, a thank you letter, to the General Service Office saying about the gay pamphlet, saying, I've never read that pamphlet. I've never picked it up. But I want you to know that when I went to my first AA meeting as a lesbian woman and didn't know if I belonged, when I looked over and passed that literature rack and saw that pamphlet sitting there, its mere presence in the rack made me feel welcome. Well, who am I to take that away then? I mean, that's how I look at myself. You know, who am I to take that away? You know, another story is the African-American pamphlet. God knows it was debated forever. At the time, I was a delegate from an urban area. I would say my African-American community was split hard, really, really hard split about whether there should be one or not. And it was two letters that I read from two African-American women from the Detroit area who had written that time, it was in my background information, that they had been going to a pastor for help since they had both been in their teens for their drinking problem. But because their religion is not willing to have a God as you understand him, because they belonged, and this is no anti-Christian rhetoric here, but just I'm just saying what their letter said. They belonged to a church where if Jesus Christ wasn't your Lord and Savior, or you went someplace that said someone else besides Jesus Christ could be, that that wasn't okay. So this particular church or religion that a lot of African Americans go to is not referring people with drinking problems to AA. And these two women spent years incarcerated in their teenage years, their 20s, and their early 30s before they found AA. And so they were saying there should be a pamphlet. And the other thing is pamphlets really aren't for AA members. They are in a way, but they're really for the people who refer people to us. They're really for the professionals who send people to us. I mean, I can tell you that, you know, we all hear this one circuit speaker who's fond of talking about that we got into this problem with drug addicts when the treatment centers couldn't afford two buses. So they only had one bus, and they took everybody to the same meeting, and they dumped them off there, and that's how we got in this problem. Well, I'm sure that could be true. I'm sure because I've sat in meetings where a treatment center doesn't care what kind of meeting they're sending people to, and I feel bad for the people. I don't feel bad that they don't belong. I feel bad that no one's taking the time to take them to the place where their solution is. Whether that is CA, NA, AA, who am I not to let you have the solution that God put on the earth for you? But I do know this, that they're definitely in the quote-unquote non-recovering world, and by that I mean AA, NA, CA, all of us 12-step groups. In the professional world, there was for a time a belief that this is a white organization and that NA is a black organization. And so when I think about that, I think about, well, that I have to feel bad for somebody who maybe is an alcoholic, a real alcoholic as described in the big book, and because of what they look like, somebody's making a decision as to what fellowship they should go to, that they're not going to get the same blessing that I got based on the illness they suffer from rather than what they look like. And so that made me change my mind on that African-American pamphlet. I'm proud that I raised my hand and I voted in favor of it, you know. And I went against my sponsor. He didn't believe in it at all. But reading those letters, you know, I was concerned, you know, that we need to dispel any kind of myth that this place is for everybody who suffers from alcoholism. Everybody. It doesn't matter who you are or what you are. Any other questions, comments? Another one. Go ahead. Right. Well, my answer to that would be, I don't think it matters what you are. If you are at the right meeting, you should be sharing the solution. And if the meeting has people with time there and people are properly sponsored, it's not about how bad your day was or how many shots of tequila Billy did or how many shot, you know, or how many spikes Johnny put in his arm of heroin. That's really not what, I mean, if you read our history, that's not what our meeting is supposed to be about. I mean, I think the old saying, share in a meeting and dump on your sponsor, was made for a reason, you know, that you may, somebody may have all those issues, but sharing about them in a meeting isn't going to fix them. Going through the steps with a sponsor is going to, whatever those other issues are, whether they are codependency or sex or gambling, whatever interfering with the sunlight of the spirit, is never going to be removed during a meeting. I hate to burst anybody's bubble. The only thing you're really going to get at a meeting is the hope to want to do that, is you know, a pep rally to say, I'm willing to go do that with somebody. For us to, like, tell someone that we're going to be able to solve their problems in 1 hour, and we're completely deceiving somebody by telling them that. That's definitely not our singleness of purpose. Our singleness of purpose is to say, we have a solution, it's worked for me, and it didn't come from sitting in meetings. And so I think we really need to be careful of that. And I don't care if you're at GA, CA, NA, SA, AA, because I've met people in all those organizations. It seems the people who stay around for a while have one thing in common. They go to meetings that focus on the recovery, and they work on those issues with someone one-on-one, because that's how it was meant to be. It's 9 o'clock. I think it's time to wrap it up, right? Any other questions, last-minute questions? Yep, go ahead.
I got one about the AA calls. I've been asking to share. I'm an alcoholic. I'm also a piece of wine.
I'm not anti that fellowship. I think what I'm saying is, by their very name and by their mission statement, they all qualify for either NA or AA. So what I'm saying is, and I'm not a member of NA, so I can't talk about them, but I'm saying, if all these people in this room of this ANA meeting qualify for either NA or AA membership or both, why didn't they feel comfortable there? What was going on in either one of those rooms or fellowships that they felt they weren't welcome and didn't have a place to recover. And so I asked that as an inventory question back at us, as what are we doing that somebody didn't feel welcome? Did we fail in sponsorship? Did we fail in being too rigid? You know, and I'm not saying that sometimes you have to say, hey, you know, you don't qualify for AA membership, or you're not an alcoholic, you know. But I'm just saying that most of those people qualify for either or, so I wonder why it got like that. That's all. You know, I don't know. Yes? Your point is very well taken. The only thing I say is individual responsibility and being willing to say something that's not popular. When I was a delegate, I was interfacing with one particular ethnic group inside AA a good bit of time in Chicago. And it was kind of like the unspoken word to never bring up, where are the women? You know, and I remember going to their convention, and on each convention seat, there was an inventory form to fill out. And the first question was, why are we not attracting women? Now, it was progress that they had it there. But sometimes we get so caught up and we don't want to offend people, almost like working with someone new, that we're afraid to say something. But I can tell you with my experience that in certain ethnic groups in this country, women are dying of alcoholism because they are not welcomed in those groups in AA. And that's just a fact. I'm not anti any group. I really want those groups to do well, but I really want those women to have a place to come as much as any woman here has a place to come. And so those are barriers. Like I said, it matches the outside world. My parents were second-generation Irish, or first-generation, really. I would think that me and my siblings have a much different view of the world than my parents do. And so I think my mother or one of her sisters would have had a lot harder time walking into AA in 1940 than I think if my sister was an alcoholic, she'd have a much easier time. So I think those things take time, but it does happen. No, not from the podium. Absolutely not. No way. Because then I'll hear that like tomorrow in the grapevine. You know? No way. It happens. Any other comments? I think we can close.